Muy buenas noches y bienvenidos una vez más al Mercurio, a este nuevo ciclo de conferencias en el plano internacional, ya que, como les contaba Verónica, abordamos muchos aspectos. Yo creo que probablemente no hay una visita que sea más pertinente que la de Hans a Chile. La verdad que el timing es perfecto, ni que lo hubiéramos planeado. Hoy día, justo cuando está Hans, que nos va a hablar de Europa y todos sus desafíos que enfrenta, está de visita la jefe de la diplomacia europea, Federica Mogherini, en Chile. Yo acabo de estar con ella en la Cancillería y donde ella está transmitiendo la visión de Europa sobre múltiples asuntos, desde el Brexit, su relación con Donald Trump y otros aspectos en que está involucrada la Unión Europea. Así que no podría ser más pertinente. Incluso está el grupo Europe tocando hoy día en Chile, así que yo creo que ya más... una broma para la gente de los 80, pero otra de las coincidencias, ¿ya? La verdad es que Europa, hasta hace muy poco, hasta 2014, la mayoría de gente lo cifra como fecha, parecía un lugar demasiado tranquilo, ¿ya? Un museo a cielo abierto, un lugar donde las democracias prosperan hacia el infinito, de la mano de las democracias liberales, ¿cierto? De la mano de los mercados prósperos. Pero la verdad es que empiezan a surgir ciertos fenómenos que nos llaman la atención y que toda esta sensación de que Europa, esta tranquilidad, se empieza a agrietar. Algunos lo ven, el origen de esto es la crisis del 2008, la crisis del euro, que vamos a estar cumpliendo casi 10 años ya de esta crisis. Pero empezamos a ver una Rusia que está más amenazante, que se empieza a acercar, ¿cierto?, al flanco este de Europa. Está su participación en la crisis de Ucrania, que la denuncia, ¿cierto?, la Unión Europea. Está también ciertos elementos nuevos, como el hecho de que Estados Unidos, bajo la administración Trump, se está alejando de Europa y de la Unión Europea, y la sociedad transatlántica ha sido fundamental para constituir lo que conocemos nosotros como Occidente. Vemos también una ola migratoria que nos trae el drama, ¿cierto?, a las puertas de Europa. Ayer, no sé si vieron las fotos, pero la gente sigue ahogándose en el Mediterráneo en este camino tan dramático para huir de la guerra y buscar una mejor calidad de vida, ¿cierto?, en los países europeos. Entonces tenemos todos estos asuntos que se están manifestando y más encima complementados por el lamentable terrorismo que vimos en la última manifestación en Manchester. ¿Cierto? Hoy día el terrorismo está pegando de una forma inusitada en cualquier rincón, en lugares que parecían tradicionalmente seguros, París, Niza, ¿cierto? Bueno, Londres lo habíamos visto más de una década atrás, pero vemos ahí Manchester, ¿cierto? Entonces están todos estos fenómenos que nos complejizan la idea de Europa y que Hans nos va a ayudar a entender. Él va a hacer una exposición para contar su visión de lo que hay de Europa y la idea que después ustedes participen con preguntas y aclaren sus dudas y tengamos todo aquí un debate de lo que es Europa hoy día. Así que, junto con agradecerle su visita, le doy paso a nuestro invitado. Gracias.
Thank you very much, Juan Pablo, for that kind introduction. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. This is my first time in Chile. I'm very grateful to El Mercurio, to Veronica, to Juan Pablo for the invitation. I'm looking forward to the discussion with you. And I should also start by apologizing for not being able to speak in Spanish. I do speak German and French, but I'm afraid I have no Spanish. I apologize for that. I'm going to try to explain what's going on in Europe. And as Juan Pablo already said, it's very, very complex. As I was trying to think about how I would just kind of talk about Europe to people who I assume aren't following this every day in the amount of detail that that I have to, unfortunately. As I was thinking about how to try to talk about this, I was reminded of something that the former US Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, once said. She said, in order to understand Europe, you have to either be a genius or French. I'm neither of those things. So I'll try to do my best to explain really what's been happening in Europe in the last 7 years since the euro crisis began in 2010, which I think really is the beginning of this story.
Excuse me, we need to talk slow because to allow the translation.
Yes, okay. And what I would like to try to do is to really talk about the concept of populism, which is something that obviously you in South America have some experience of. And I think that might help make this more understandable and more relevant to you. And clearly, this phenomenon of populism now exists throughout the West, and the most dramatic, most important expression of it, I think, is the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States last year. But it's also something that exists throughout Europe, increasingly so. In the French election earlier this year, just a couple of months ago, Marine Le Pen nearly became elected as French president. But you also have these populist parties really throughout the whole of the European Union. And really what I want to talk about is why it is that populism expresses itself in Europe as Euroscepticism. In other words, why is it that these populist parties across the EU, in the north, in the south, in the east, in the west, on the left and on the right, all have this one thing in common, which is that they're opposed to the European Union specifically, which, as Juan Pablo indicated 10 years or so ago, looked like a very benign phenomenon. Europeans, I think, many Europeans still think of the European Union in this way as a peace project that brought Europeans together. Why would there be so much anger directed against the European Union? As I said, I think it's really against the background of this series of crises during the last 7 years since 2010, beginning with the euro crisis, that Euroscepticism and populism has been increasing in Europe. The polls show this quite clearly, that the degree of trust in the European Union has been decreasing since then, during the last 10 years, essentially. And throughout the European Union. It used to be the case that Britain, which has always been a special case in many ways because it's had this semi-detached relationship with the European Union, it used to be that Britain was a kind of an exception. But if you look at the data, actually now it's kind of become normal, actually. So in particular, other countries like Italy and Spain, which were very pro-EU in the past, have now similar levels of mistrust and disapproval in the European Union as in Britain itself. And I think that the two main aspects of what's happened in the last 7 years that have led to this increase in Euroscepticism have been, firstly, the euro crisis itself, and secondly, the refugee crisis, the migration crisis, which you mentioned, Juan Pablo. And in both cases, what's happened is that fault lines have emerged within the European Union between EU member states. So in the case of the euro crisis, which began as the Greek debt crisis, essentially, and then turned, I would argue, mainly because of the German response to the crisis, to the Greek crisis, the refusal by Germany to stand behind Greek debt. And essentially, I would argue, to take an approach to the Greek crisis is very similar to the approach that the United States took, for example, in the Latin American debt crisis, something, again, that I think makes it more familiar to people here. Essentially to say, we will give you loans, but in exchange for structural reforms, which was the approach of the International Monetary Fund in Latin America after the Latin American debt crisis. That led to a big fault line between creditor countries and debtor countries. Essentially, you can think of it as being between the north and the south of Europe, the north being the creditor countries, with Germany as by far the most important, biggest creditor country, and the south being the debtors. That remains unresolved, and essentially, Europeans are having the same argument that they've been having for the last 7 years. And then in 2015, the refugee crisis began, which has been the other big factor behind the rise of these populist Eurosceptic parties. And in the case of the refugee crisis, rather than a fault line between the north and the south, a new fault line opened up between the east and the west. Essentially, the western EU member states, again, led by Germany as the most important country, where most of the refugees wanted to go for obvious reasons, along with Sweden, they were in favour of redistributing these refugees throughout the whole of the EU. And the eastern member states, the new member states that joined the European Union after the end of the Cold War, essentially refused to do this. And in both cases, I think, the Euro crisis and the refugee crisis, I think essentially what was happening was that individual countries in Europe were wanting to turn their own national problems into European problems to get the help of other EU member states where they needed it, but were also refusing to allow other EU member states to turn their national problems into European problems, because then they would have to show some kind of solidarity, whether that was financially in the case of the Euro crisis or by allowing refugees to come into their country in the refugee crisis. Now, as I say, a lot of Europeans, I think, are baffled as to why this series of crises has led to this increase in Euroscepticism. And I want to suggest to you that the way to think about this is as a kind of a crisis of globalization. I think, essentially, what's happening here when Europeans argue about the Euro crisis and the refugee crisis is that they're having an argument about the limits of globalization. Over the last 30 or 40 years or so, the process of globalization, by which I essentially mean the removal of barriers to the movement of capital, goods, and people, this process of globalization, the removal of these barriers, has accelerated massively. There was a period for about 30 years after the end of World War II where there was a kind of a moderate form of globalization. Trade was liberalized, the global economy became more open, but there was a kind of a balance between the between markets and states, essentially. And what started to happen really starting in the late 70s, but particularly after the end of the Cold War, was that this process of globalization was accelerated. And the Harvard political scientist Danny Roderick calls this second phase hyperglobalization. So it's a kind of an extreme form of globalization. And in many ways, this has been a great thing for the world. It's lifted millions of people out of poverty in Asia, for example, in many other parts of the world. But I think what we're now seeing, and the election of Trump and the vote by the British people to leave the European Union, the Brexit vote, are the two biggest, most dramatic expressions of this. I think we're now seeing a kind of a pushback against this form of hyper-globalization. Since the Brexit vote and since the election of Trump, there's been lots of discussion, particularly in Britain and America, but elsewhere as well, about the so-called losers from globalization. Both the election of Trump and the Brexit vote have been interpreted as a kind of revolt by the losers of globalization. There's a very interesting chart that illustrates something called the elephant curve, which is essentially the story of the winners and losers of globalization over the last 30, 40 years. And the reason it's called the elephant curve is because it kind of looks like an elephant. And so it has this big hump. And that hump is essentially these literally millions of people in outside the West, mainly, particularly in China, to some extent in India, who have done very, very well over the last 30, 40 years. They've been lifted out of poverty. And then the hump goes down, and then it goes up like the trunk of an elephant. And that illustrates basically what's happened in the West as a consequence of globalization. The poorer parts of the West have actually done quite badly. Wages have stagnated. And these were many of the people that voted for Trump in the sort of post-manufacturing regions of America. Similarly, in Britain, in the north of England, for example, people that voted for Brexit, basically people in parts of the West where wages have stagnated over the last 30, 40 years. And then, as I say, there's this trunk, which is the very, very rich in the West, who've also done very, very well out of globalization. And so there've been this complex picture of winners and losers, and there seems now to be a revolt by the losers. And my argument is that the European Union, you can think of, if what's happened over the last 30, 40 years is hyper-globalization, then I think you can think of the European Union as being hyper-hyper-globalization. Because this process of the removal of barriers to capital, goods, and people has gone even further in the European Union than it has elsewhere in the world over the last 30, 40 years. So the European Union is based on these so-called four freedoms, which are, again, the freedom of movement of capital and goods and services and workers. And over the last 30 years in particular, the European Union has gone much, much further in completing the removal of those barriers. And in particular, the freedom of movement of people, which was one of the main reasons for lots of people in Britain voting to leave the European Union, has gone very far. So essentially, within the European Union now, any citizen, any of the 500 million citizens of the EU can move to another EU member state tomorrow, and that's a right that they have as EU citizens. And essentially what led to the British decision to leave last summer was that David Cameron, the British Prime Minister at the time, tried to negotiate some restrictions to that principle of freedom of movement, and he was told by other EU leaders that you can't do that, because this is so fundamental to the EU. And it seems as if that was one of the main factors leading British voters to leave the EU. I think we can think of the European Union as being this kind of extreme form of globalization, with all the good things about globalization, but all of the bad things as well. And one of the bad things, I think, is that essentially, you have it's a sort of ultimate experiment in technocratic governance, where what you have is a series of rules. I mean, essentially, in the same way as in order to make globalization work at the global level, you have to have a series of rules by which countries agree to carry out trade and so on. And essentially, that's the World Trade Organization rules. Similarly, in the EU, you have a system of rules over which national governments actually have no power anymore. And so it becomes this very technocratic system of governance where people feel as if decision-making is being taken further and further away from the citizen, and they have no power anymore to take these very, very important decisions about redistribution, for example. And so I think it's no coincidence that both in the American presidential election last year and in the Brexit referendum, there was lots of talk about regaining control. We want to regain control of our borders was what lots of British people said during the EU referendum. And so now I think what you have is this kind of complex revolt against globalization, and in particular within the EU, against the EU's kind of extreme form of this. And it takes different forms on the left and the right. So the left tends to be increasingly in revolt against the free market, in other words, the freedom of movement of goods and capital. And the right increasingly is in revolt against the freedom of movement of people, in other words, against immigration. I think this is the same pattern we see in America, in Britain, and elsewhere in the EU. And so I think the ultimate question, and this is really where I'll stop for the moment, is essentially whether this kind of loss of control that globalization has led to is inevitable, and irreversible, and whether there's simply nothing we can do about it, which what lots of supporters of globalization and supporters of the European Union would say is the case. You have to simply accept this. Governments can't control these things anymore. This is the world we live in. it's a good thing in some ways. You have to just accept it, and all we can do is mitigate the effects a little bit, but essentially we have to accept this, or whether there's a way of rethinking globalization and, in the context of Europe, rethinking the European Union to perhaps restrict some of these freedoms a little bit more in order to make it sustainable in the long term. I think that's the big question that Europeans face, but I think it's also more broadly the big question that actually the whole world now faces.
Muchas gracias. Parto yo con la primera pregunta. Para Chile es muy importante lo que pasa con Europa, por muchas razones. Es nuestro principal, el principal, como actor único, el principal inversionista en Chile, más que Estados Unidos, más que China. Aparte, el tercer mercado de Chile también, en términos de comercio. Y la verdad que, como decía hoy día la canciller, en nuestra cancillería, la canciller europea, es que coincidimos en la mayor parte de los puntos de política exterior, sobre misiones de paz, sobre temas de derechos humanos, coincidimos también en temas de cambio climático, tenemos muchos puntos en común. En ese sentido, ¿tú crees que finalmente, bajo todas estas presiones, Europa realmente puede tomar ahora la rienda de su destino, como dijo la canciller Merkel? Y vuelvo a lo que dijo Verónica en la introducción, al llamado que hizo ella, dijo, bueno, ya no podemos confiar más en los otros, Estados Unidos, Gran Bretaña, obviamente no lo dijo, pero hoy día Trump le respondió, dijo, ¿podemos ahora tomar la rienda de nuestro destino? Y salieron los italianos y los holandeses a decirle, vamos Merkel, vamos detrás de ti. ¿Tú crees que eso es posible el día que Europa, al final del día, salga más fortalecida de toda esta situación?
I wish it were. I think, actually, this is the tragedy of the current situation, is that now that Trump is the president of the United States, and in particular has put the U.S. security guarantee into question, it's no longer clear, actually, whether Article 5 of NATO, which is the collective defense clause that means that the United States will stand behind European countries if they're attacked. It's no longer clear if that applies. This moment is precisely the moment when you would need a very united, coherent Europe that could respond to that situation in a positive way. And if all of the things that I described over the last 7 years hadn't have happened, then I might have had some confidence that it would be possible for Europeans to do this, that it would be possible for them to get behind Merkel as the sort of de facto leader of Europe. But the tragedy, I think, is that it's sort of almost too late now, precisely because of everything that's happened over the last 7 years, which has really damaged the European Union, and in particular has created a lot of resentment towards Germany. So, I mean, we can talk more about Germany, but I think it essentially means that it's very difficult to see how the whole of Europe now gets behind Merkel. The reality is actually that a lot of what Trump says, for example, when he criticizes Germany for its current account surplus and for its approach to trade more generally, the reality is that lots of Europeans actually agree with Trump. And in particular, when Trump made some of these comments a few weeks ago, immediately Matteo Renzi, the Italian Prime Minister, who had made similar arguments in a much more sophisticated way himself when he was Italian Prime Minister, immediately came out and said, well, actually, I kind of agree with Trump here. He has a point. So Trump expresses this in a crazy kind of way, but actually lots of Europeans share his criticisms of Germany in many ways. And this sense, which I think is a really important point, this sense that Trump expressed at one point that the EU has become a vehicle for Germany. That, I think, is a very dangerous perception, but it has some basis in truth, actually. The European Union was created as a way to overcome hegemony. You know, we had centuries of bids for hegemony in Europe, by Spain, by France under Napoleon, then by Germany in the 20th century. And the European Union was meant to be a response to this. And so there's something ironic and really problematic, I think, this is largely what my book is about the way that over the last 7 years since the Euro crisis began, we're now talking again about Germany being a kind of hegemon in Europe. That illustrates, I mean, if it's true, I don't think it is true, but if it is true, it illustrates that the EU has actually failed because it was meant to overcome hegemony in Europe.
Perfecto. ¿Cuán importante en este sentido, y da, ya, yo veo que eres un poco escéptico y sé por la entrevista que te hice sobre el futuro de la Unión Europea, porque es un poco tarde, como tú dices, también para contener esta fuerza centrífuga? Ahora, ¿cuál importante sería la dupla que pueden hacer Merkel con el nuevo presidente francés, Emmanuel Macron? Porque su primera reunión en Berlín se llevaron bastante bien. Ambos se comprometieron a trabajar juntos y a reactivar lo que llamamos la locomotora, ¿cierto? Alemania y Francia, que tira a la Unión Europea hacia adelante. Y vimos, no sé, bueno, Merkel está haciendo un poco frente a Trump y ayer vimos a Macron haciéndole una jugada maestra a Putin. Lo llevó a Versalles y no al Palacio del Eliseo, con lo cual le pone la historia de Francia encima y le dice, nosotros también fuimos un imperio y tu admirado Pedro el Grande sacó las ideas de acá, de Francia. Y por otro lado también incluso lo llevó manejando en un carrito de golf, cosa que generalmente es Putin el que va en el caballo, el que va en el auto, en el avión o en el barco, lo que sea. Todo lo cual fue una jugada comunicacional, si ustedes, no sé si pueden discrepar, coinciden, pero la verdad, para inédita para un presidente muy joven y en cierto sentido también le marcó sus líneas rojas. Interesante ese caso. ¿Tú crees que puede haber una dupla ahí que se reanude, se complemente? Porque la verdad, con Hollande, Merkel se la veía muy distante y tenía muchas diferencias. De hecho, Hollande cuestionó mucho su modelo de austeridad y dijo lo mío, el crecimiento. Al final no creció Francia, pero...
Yeah. So I really hope so, and there is a chance, I think. And I think Macron is a really exciting figure, partly because he's so young, but he has created this party from scratch, and it is quite remarkable what he's already done. The question, though, I think there are two questions. Firstly, whether there can be some kind of deal between France and Germany, and then secondly, whether that's enough. And that second point, I think, is important because I think it's no longer the case that if France and Germany agree, then the whole of the rest of the EU kind of falls in behind them. It used to be the case a long time ago when the EU was much smaller. But essentially, since the EU has enlarged, particularly to include Central and Eastern European countries, it's no longer enough for France and Germany to reach an agreement. It's a necessary but not a sufficient condition for having the coherence of the EU as a whole. But there are also, I think, real question marks about whether France and Germany can even reach this kind of compromise. Because I think it would have to, I mean, Germany would have to make a series of concessions to France that I hope it makes, but I'm not sure that it will. The German response to the election of Macron, I was in Germany a couple of weeks ago, immediately after Macron has been elected, and the Spiegel, which as some of you know, is the sort of probably the most important news magazine, weekly news magazine in Germany, had this cover with a picture of Macron, which I think essentially captures the way that Germans are thinking about this. It showed Macron, and it said the headline was "Cher ami," dear friend, and then it said Macron is going to save Europe, but how much is Germany going to have to pay? And this is really the way that Germans have thought about the Euro crisis since it began. To put it rather simply, that the rest of Europe wants Germany's money. And so they see Macron as a sort of rather clever kind of new attempt to create what the Germans call a transfer union, which is this sort of idea of a European Union where the fiscally responsible countries, the North, particularly Germany, endlessly subsidize the fiscally irresponsible countries, the South, in particular Greece. And so they're very, very cautious about anything that goes in the direction of a mutualization of Eurozone debt. Now, I hope that that changes with Macron. And he is promising a series of things which Germans like to hear about, like structural reform. And I hope that Germany is prepared to make those kind of concessions, because I think this is now virtually the last chance for the EU to solve these problems that began in 2010. I hope this happens, but as I say, so far my impression is that Germans are still very, very cautious about making any concessions to Macron.
¿Y tú ves Alemania jugando un rol mayor en Europa y de alguna forma en el mundo? Uno, Merkel tiene el prestigio ganado. Según si se cumple más o menos la encuesta, la matemática electoral estaría en condiciones de ganar la próxima elección de septiembre, o sea, su partido, ¿cierto? Los demócratas cristianos, y extender su mandato, que sería el mandato más largo desde Helmut Kohl, incluso. Entonces tiene un liderazgo reconocido en el mundo, tiene la billetera, como dijiste tú, que es grande también, la billetera alemana, y muchos quieren su plata, ¿cierto? Pero ¿la ves jugando un rol mayor en el mundo, dadas las circunstancias actuales? Casi que por obligación, ¿es cierto? Tú decías, y en tu libro, el libro que están vendiendo ahí, la tesis, un poco de que pocos países han huido, rehuido tanto el liderazgo y se han encontrado de cara con él. O sea, como que hay como una demanda de liderazgo y de alguna forma, creo que lo decía Henry Kissinger, lo decía de una forma muy gráfica, el problema con la Unión Europea o con Europa es que cuando yo quiero hablar con Europa, ¿a quién llamo? ¿No? ¿A qué teléfono marco? ¿No? Bueno, no sé, ahora probablemente marcaría Berlín. ¿Tú ves a Alemania lista para jugar un mayor rol?
It already is playing a kind of a major role, but I think the question is exactly what kind of a role. And I think that the kind of expectations that people have of Germany are too high. And since the election of Trump, I think they've become completely ridiculous, frankly. So this idea of Merkel as the leader of the free world, I think, is really absurd. And Merkel herself said so. She described it as grotesque and absurd. And part of the reason for that is that, you know, Germany is kind of a powerful country, and it is the most important country in the EU. But it's a very particular kind of power, and this is what I try to describe in the book. Because it's largely economic power. Germany doesn't have military power that's comparable even with Britain and France, let alone with the United States. I mean, the comparison between the US as a military power and Germany, I mean, it's just an absurd comparison because Germany is so underdeveloped in terms of military resources. And this is why, this is the main reason, I think, why this idea that Merkel can somehow replace the president of the United States as the leader of the free world is so absurd. Insofar as that term, the leader of the free world, made any sense when it was applied to the US president basically during the Cold War, it essentially was referring to the way that the United States, the US president, had at his disposal military resources which the United States was prepared to deploy to defend democracy. Now, we could have a long argument about whether the US really did that, and this country is probably a particularly complicated place to have that discussion. But insofar as that term, leader of the free world, made sense, it was because of this military power that the US was prepared to use to defend democracy. And Germany just simply doesn't have those resources. It's dependent on the United States for its security. It can't even defend itself, let alone defend other countries. And so insofar as, you know, I think actually the role that Merkel plays now is something much more like, I mean, if you go back to the Cold War and you look for a comparison, it's something like Sweden in the Cold War. It's some kind of moral leadership. Mm. And I would dispute even that Germany has that kind of moral leadership, not least because it's not accepted within Europe. But insofar as it has any kind of leadership role, it's essentially this kind of moral leadership. That's very, very different from the role that the United States has played and will and still plays. So I think the sad reality is that the free world no longer has a leader.
Por un lado, tú dices, bueno, de repente es demasiado tarde para atajar estas presiones que están en el fondo debilitando la Unión Europea por los resentimientos que hay por las exigencias de austeridad que le hacen los países prestamistas a los países acreedores, ¿cierto? Por otro lado, vemos una Alemania que parece no está dispuesto a jugar este liderazgo, este rol mayor que se le está demandando. Entonces, ¿podemos ver más países siguiendo el camino del Brexit a futuro? ¿Te imaginas, cómo te imaginas una Unión Europea más, una Europa más? ¿Más chica, pero quizás con los que son más ordenados del curso, por ponerlo, pero y los otros más chicos que, o por último los otros que no quieren salir, se empiezan a salir y empiezan a formar sus propios clubes? Una Europa tal vez de dos velocidades, como una primera división del fútbol y una segunda división. ¿Cómo te imaginas? ¿El proyecto se salva? ¿Se achica?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't really have a good answer because it's so unpredictable now. My instinct is that Britain is basically a special case. As I mentioned earlier, Britain has this very particular history which meant that it was never really committed to its membership of the European Union. It joined rather late. And it's not surprising in a way that it's the first country to leave. The way I think of this is that Winston Churchill famously, immediately after World War II, was asked to describe Britain's role in the world. And he drew on a piece of paper three circles, intersecting circles. We called the three majestic circles. One was Europe. The second was the Commonwealth, you know, the former empire, and the third was the United States. And he said, Britain's role is in the middle. And what that illustrates, I think, is that Britain has always seen Europe as one option among many. And I think what's happening now, if you look at the British decision to leave the EU, in this long history of British identity and British foreign policy, I think what's happening is that Britain is kind of switching a little bit away from Europe as one of these three options to the two other options. One of those two options, the United States, has been made very complicated because of Trump, but that's another story. In any case, I don't think many other European countries have these other options. And I think they're committed to the European Union with all its problems in a way that Britain isn't. So I don't see countries leaving. Also, I think will depend to a large extent on what happens with Brexit, because right now it's such a mess that the immediate effect of Brexit, I think, has been to scare other EU member states into staying in the EU, and that's reflected in the polls. There was a time, you know, about a year ago, a little bit before a year ago, where if you ask people in particularly the Netherlands and France whether they would vote to leave, the numbers actually were quite high, but they've dropped a lot. But that's really just because of fear. So I think to a large extent, the reason that now people find it very difficult to imagine leaving the EU, copying Britain, leaving the EU, is just because of fear. And so I think in the long run, that's not sustainable. You can't keep the European Union together on the basis of fear. There has to be a more positive reason to stay in the European Union. So I see what I see happening over the next, let's say, 10 years is just a very long process of these fault lines and these conflicts that have emerged over the last 7 years continuing, getting worse in some ways, maybe being resolved in some ways, but I think this process is going to go on for a very, very long time. And at the end of it, what happens, whether the EU exists at the end of it, I don't know.
Perfecto. La idea es que nos hagan llegar sus preguntas. No quiero, bueno, las están recogiendo ahí. No quiero monopolizar las preguntas, pero mientras nos las hacen llegar, te pregunto, tú como británico, si bien estás viviendo en Estados Unidos, ¿conoces gente o amigos tuyos, conocidos, que estén tomando, por ejemplo, la decisión de irse de Gran Bretaña? Porque sé que las instituciones financieras, la banca, por ejemplo, está pensando en trasladar oficinas a Frankfurt, que es la otra capital financiera, ¿cierto? Y sacarlas de la City de Londres. Leía que han aumentado las demandas de pasaporte irlandeses, mucho británico que tiene origen irlandés y ahora que el pasaporte británico va a tener pasaporte comunitario. ¿Conoces gente o casos? Porque una de las cosas, si queremos ver el vaso medio lleno o el efecto aleccionador del Brexit, es que los que querían votar por salirse de la Unión Europea están viendo el costo que tiene, están pensando nuevo. O sea, si veo, va a tener que cruzar el canal ya y va a tener que presentar el pasaporte cada vez que entre a Francia o entre a Alemania, ya cambian las cosas. ¿Cómo está cambiando la vida? ¿Y tienes alguna noción?
I don't know anybody who actually is thinking of leaving Britain as a consequence of this. But I do know people who are trying to get a second passport. So for example, a German passport or an Irish, there's a huge demand for Irish passports, as you said, as a kind of insurance policy, I suppose. I have to say, I think that it's rather premature, because my suspicion is that these questions will be resolved, that it won't be the case that you will need some kind of visa to travel from Britain to the EU or the other way around. I think this is in everybody's interests to resolve this, and I think that it will be resolved. And in the very worst case scenario, there might be some minor bureaucracy that you have to go through. But I don't think it's going to prevent people from Britain being able to move to the rest of the EU or vice versa. But maybe that's wrong. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic.
¿Tú mantienes el pasaporte? ¿Mantienes el pasaporte británico?
Of course, absolutely. I only have a British passport. I don't have any other options, I'm afraid. My mother is Dutch, so I did investigate long before Brexit. I did investigate whether I might be able to get a Dutch passport, but it turned out that I couldn't. So I don't really have very many other options. So I'm stuck with my British passport, unless I get an American passport if I stay in America longer. I'm not sure I want that either right now.
Bueno, gracias. Damos paso a las preguntas de ustedes. Cristina pregunta, ¿qué nos puede comentar de los partidos piratas? ¿Cree usted que además del euro y las migraciones se está gestando una crisis de oportunidades y derechos?
Huh, I'm not sure if I understand the question. Does the question refer specifically to the pirate party in Germany?
En general, dice, ¿quién nos puede comentar de los partidos piratas? Pues no solo hay en Alemania, también en Islandia, en otro, pero es una anomalía, una curiosidad, no sé. ¿A qué responden estos partidos? A mí no se me ocurriría, bueno, ahora podría surgir un partido pirata, pero con todos los partidos que hay en Chile, pero...
I mean,
Maybe I'm
misunderstanding the question, but I think there is a phenomenon throughout Europe of the political. I mean, this really comes back to the question of populism. The political centre, the centre right and centre left parties, are being wiped out across Europe. And you have extremist parties on the far right and the far left, but also new parties in the centre emerging. And Macron, I think, is the best illustration of this. If you look at the French election, it's quite extraordinary that the second round of the French election has neither the Republicans, the main centre-right party, nor a candidate from the Socialist Party in it. It has Macron, who was in the Hollande government, the Socialist government, but has created a new party in the centre. So I think what the question was driving at was whether established political parties, whether there's a kind of crisis of established political parties, and that does seem to be the case, at least in Europe. Spain, which I'm sure some of you know quite well, is probably one of the best illustrations of this as well, the way that, again, the Socialist Party and the PP are being they're losing support, and you have these new parties like Podemos coming along.
A pesar de que han pasado más de 70 años desde el fin de la Segunda Guerra Mundial, ¿cuán vigente está hoy el trauma del Holocausto nazi en las decisiones políticas más duras de Alemania?
Wow. That's a great question. I think that it's becoming less important. I think the story is essentially that you can think of the history of post-war Germany in three phases, if you like. The first phase, where really nobody talked about the Holocaust, not just in Germany, but even in Israel and elsewhere, it really only starts in the 1960s. That this becomes something that people talk about. The survivors really only started talking about this in the 1960s as well. And so in West Germany at that time, this is when the whole discussion around the Holocaust and Germany's responsibility for the Holocaust begins. And I think it reaches its kind of high point in the 1990s, when the Holocaust was this very present factor in German politics and in the discourse in Germany. And the best expression of this is the way that immediately after the end of the Cold War, when the center of Berlin was being reconstructed, the government decided to build a Holocaust memorial right in the center of the capital of Germany. It's quite an extraordinary thing. But I think what's happened since the late 1990s is that the Holocaust has receded in importance. And so, for example, if you look at German foreign policy, this was what my first book was about. Now it doesn't really play a role in German foreign policy in the way that it used to. So I think it's becoming less important.
Aquí con el permiso de Mario Apelius y de otra persona voy a unificar estas preguntas, pero son el mismo tema. Mario Apelius pregunta, si Trump deja caer la OTAN, sale la OTAN o por lo menos relaja su compromiso con la OTAN, como dio a entender o no dio a entender el otro día, ¿permitirá al resto de Europa que Alemania vuelva a tener y manejar armamento? Pone Mario Apelius, I mean real weapons. Yo me imagino que es el estratégico, ese tipo. Y la otra pregunta es, ¿qué impide que crezca militarmente Alemania para que pueda convertirse en un verdadero líder europeo? O sea, ¿va a tener poder militar de verdad? Este que tú dices que no tiene mucho. Sabemos que hay un aumento presupuestal.
I don't think Germany will become at least not for a long time. I don't think it will become a it's already a significant military power. I shouldn't exaggerate the extent of Germany's unwillingness to develop military resources and to deploy military resources. It is a significant country in that respect, but it does have this reluctance, which goes back to its history. I mean, it goes back to the previous question, actually. It does have a certain reluctance to think of itself as a military power. And so I think the answer to the question, which was, what's stopping Germany from becoming a significant military power, is Germany itself. Mm. And so the extraordinary thing, I think, is that even after the way that all of the developments over the last few years, but particularly the Ukraine crisis, which you mentioned at the beginning, it's increasingly clear that that Russia is a threat, not directly to Germany itself, but to some of the countries in the east of Europe, particularly the Baltic states and Poland. Even after all of these developments, Germany remains very reluctant to spend more money on defense. So there's this big debate which Trump has been a big part of about burden sharing within NATO, Germany, NATO countries are committed to spend 2% of their GDP on defence. Germany spends under 1.2%, and it's long been criticised by the United States, but by other European countries as well for not spending enough. And even now that there is this doubt about the US security guarantee, there's huge reluctance in Germany to do more to spend more money on defence. It's a big factor now in the election campaign. There's a general election in Germany in September, and the Social Democrats, the opposition party, one of the opposition parties, are flatly refusing to commit to this NATO goal of 2%, and lots of people in Germany agree with that position. So I think it will take a very long time before German attitudes to the use of military force change.
Aquí dos preguntas que también están básicamente unidas. María Los Ángeles Aguilar nos lleva un buen punto porque hemos hablado de la Unión Europea, que es un organismo supranacional, y de los Estados-naciones, los países, Alemania, cierto, Francia. Pero nos pregunta ella, ¿qué pasa con los reinos, las monarquías? ¿Van a desaparecer? Y si así, ¿cuándo? Porque hasta ahora han sobrevivido con más o menos salud, y eso nos lleva a una monarquía y a un reino que es el Reino Unido. Y te pregunta, ¿qué pasa con Escocia, Irlanda del Norte, Gales, cierto, Irlanda en sí misma? Porque básicamente mucho el argumento para convencer a los escoceses en su último referéndum para que no se salieran del Reino Unido fue que si se salían, se iban a salir de la Unión Europea. Y ahora se encuentra con la paradoja que Reino Unido que se está saliendo en su conjunto. ¿Qué pasa con la monarquía?
So I suppose there's two questions really. One is about monarchies within the EU, and the other is about the future of the United Kingdom, right? So on the first question about monarchies within, I mean, it's a great question. I've never been asked that before. I don't know what happens to the monarchies. I suppose they just continue to exist until you get to a point which now looks very, very unlikely that you would have some kind of political union. In other words, the creation of something like a United States of Europe, a kind of European republic, as it were. Then I think you would have this question about, well, who would be the head of state? And you'd have to either be a republic or a monarchy. And I think there would be a real question about European monarchies. But that looks very, very unlikely. Not least, I mean, this isn't the main reason why a European republic looks very unlikely. But one of the reasons is that people in the Netherlands and Sweden and other countries are very attached to their monarchs, and they wouldn't want to become part of a European republic. So I don't think the monarchs of Europe are worried about losing their thrones. Let me put it that way. Then the future of the United Kingdom. Yes, as you said, Juan Pablo, there is this bizarre situation now where Britain is leaving the European Union, and this increases the likelihood that Scotland will leave the United Kingdom. So Britain leaving the EU leads to a breakup of Britain. And the extraordinary thing about that is that it's the Conservative Party in Britain which is driving Brexit, and the Conservative Party always stood for the Union. So the idea that a Conservative British Prime Minister would be responsible for the breakup of Britain is just a very bizarre thing that that I didn't think I would experience. Having said that, it's not yet clear that, firstly, that there will be a referendum in Scotland to leave the United Kingdom, and secondly, even if there were a referendum, it's really not clear that the Scottish people would vote to leave. It's very unclear at the moment, but there are good reasons to think that the Scottish people won't want to leave the United Kingdom. There are economic reasons, there are kind of reasons to do with the position that they would have in the European Union. And in particular, it looks as if Scotland were to leave the United Kingdom and become a member of the European Union itself, it would probably have to adopt the euro, which the Scottish people, I would argue rightly, don't want to do.
Nos preguntan ahora por la relación de Europa con otras potencias. Primero, ¿qué papel ves a China en el futuro de Europa? El próximo, este jueves viene, hay una, de hecho una cumbre China-Unión Europea. Eso contaba la canciller europea aquí hace poco en Chile, que se iba para allá, que había estado en Latinoamérica, y después se va a ir a África, lo cual muestra en el fondo que Europa también ya está mirando para el lado, en el fondo, como Estados Unidos está, parece, jugando su propia carta y está aplicando Trump el America First, que era su lema de campaña, ¿cierto? Estados Unidos primero. Rodrigo Jorquera nos lleva este tema, el papel de China en el futuro de Europa.
That's a great question. It's a very, very important question. I think essentially the role of China in Europe is actually remarkably similar to the role of China in other parts of the world, whether that's in Africa or in South America, actually. So I think you can kind of read across from what you know of the Chinese role in South America. It's roughly similar in Europe. So you have Chinese investment in Europe, which creates a kind of economic dependence on China and translates into political power. And so I think the interesting thing is the way that, I talked earlier on about the euro crisis and the way this created this fault line between the creditors and the debtors in Europe. And what's interesting to me is that both the creditors and the debtors in different ways are becoming more economically dependent on China. So the creditors, again, the sort of paradigmatic case would be Germany, is becoming increasingly dependent on China as an export market. It's selling more and more cars and machinery to Germany. And there are some extraordinary figures. For example, Volkswagen, I think 62% of its net profit now comes from China, which is quite extraordinary dependence. And then similarly, the debtor countries, with Greece as the kind of paradigmatic case, are becoming increasingly dependent on China for investment. So there are these differences, but in different ways, all EU member states are becoming increasingly dependent on China. And you can already see the consequences of this, for example, in the way that the EU doesn't talk about human rights in China in the way that it used to. No head of government in the EU will now receive the Dalai Lama because various EU member states did this. Britain was the last one to do it. Cameron was the last head of government to do this. And what happened was that the Chinese would punish them in various ways, mainly economic ways. And so they've essentially stopped doing this. So I think we're all becoming more economically dependent on China. I find this very worrying. And now the additional factor is that since the election of Trump, I think this may accelerate this process whereby Europeans say, well, we need alternative partners to the US, and maybe China is a potential partner for us. Maybe China, I think this is wrong, but I think there is a tendency in Europe to say, well, you know, we believe in globalization and the liberal international order, and maybe China can be a partner in upholding it, even if the US can't. And I think a particular area where this is going to be really important is climate change, because climate change is something that Europeans feel very strongly about, and rightly or wrongly, they see China as now a more important partner, or more reliable partner than the United States under Trump.
¿Y qué piensas sobre la relación también de China con el Reino Unido, y China-India? Bueno, la última visita de los líderes chinos a Reino Unido se tradujo en millones de dólares, compromiso, inversión. Van a relajar también las políticas de visa para los chinos que van a Reino Unido. Y por lo que sé, también el Reino Unido está sumándose a esta iniciativa del Banco de Inversión e Infraestructura de Asia, que lidera líder China. ¿Ese es un acercamiento también importante para el Reino Unido y también la relación con India? Preguntan acá. Y esto a través de la ruta, nueva ruta de la seda que está vendiendo hoy día China como un proyecto de comercio global.
Yes, I mean, you're right that Britain over the last few years has had a particularly sycophantic approach to China. And the goal has basically, this is particularly under the previous Prime Minister, David Cameron, the goal was essentially to turn the City of London into a centre for trading in renminbis. But I would argue that actually this all actually began with Germany, because Germany was the country that was the first to try to develop this kind of special relationship with China that you were describing, Juan Pablo. This was largely on the basis, as I described, of German exports to China, but a very close political relationship developed between China and Germany. And I think essentially what David Cameron was trying to do was to try to compete with Germany in relations with China. But because Britain isn't a big exporter like Germany is, it did so using different different methods, and that was essentially financial services and the City of London. But I think it's quite a worrying trend.
Y hablemos aquí, nos preguntan también cómo ves el futuro, en el futuro de Europa, la relación con Rusia, ¿no? Parece bastante tensa en algunos momentos, pero sabemos que Europa es sumamente dependiente de la energía de Rusia. 30% del gas, por ejemplo, que se consume en Alemania, sí, depende allá. Son grandes compradores de autos alemanes por su calidad también. ¿Cómo se inserta esto? Vemos un Putin que parece muy firme en sus convicciones, muy, muy popular en su país, o sea, tiene niveles de 80-90%, la verdad que visto como el líder fuerte que Rusia espera tener, y esa es la visión del liderazgo ruso, ¿ves que esta relación se puede complicar más aún o incluso fomentar la unidad de Europa, que parece ser lo que está haciendo? O sea, generalmente los países que se unen son porque tienen un enemigo común, eso, la historia ha enseñado eso, ¿no?
Yes, I think that's right. That does seem to have been what has happened in the last couple of years since the Ukraine crisis began, is that some people talk about Putin as an external federator. In other words, he's kind of forced Europeans together. I think that is true to some extent. But there have been these tensions, again, between EU member states, and each EU member state has a different economic relationship with Russia, as you described. So some are more dependent on Russia than others, whether it's in terms of energy or in terms of exports. But then also countries have different strategic cultures and different collective memories and different identities. And that all those things all affect the way that countries think about Russia. And they in particular affect the extent to which people think of Russia as a threat. Some countries see it more as a threat than others. So there is also a potential for Russia to divide Europe. And now you have this additional factor which has made it even more complex, which is the unpredictability of Trump and his relationship with Russia. For the last kind of 3 years since the Ukraine crisis began, the discussion has all been about how, I mean, it's all been based on the assumption that the Americans are tough on Russia and the Europeans are kind of weak. So there was this constant fear that the economic sanctions which the West, Europe and the United States had imposed on Russia, that at some point the Europeans were going to give up on these sanctions because they were too expensive in terms of exports, for example. And now you have this bizarre situation, which still makes my head kind of spin, really, that suddenly the US is actually quite soft on Russia. I mean, at least that's the fear. Nothing really has happened so far. But actually, suddenly the Europeans look quite tough. It's the Europeans who are insisting we have to keep the economic sanctions going, because they are tied to the annexation of Crimea and so on. And unless the Russians make certain concessions on Crimea and on eastern Ukraine, we can't lift the sanctions. So suddenly it's the other way around. So it all looks very, very unpredictable now. If the US were at some point to lift sanctions against Russia, then I think it would be very difficult for the Europeans to continue. And I think it's also worth pointing out that you have lots of Europeans who have been very unhappy about this quite aggressive approach to Russia over the last couple of years, and would love to lift the sanctions. A good illustration of this is that in the French presidential election, essentially, of the four leading candidates, three of the four were quite pro-Russian, actually. Macron, who won, is the only one of the four who was quite tough on Russia. The other three, including Marine Le Pen, essentially, Marine Le Pen, by the way, was being financed partly by Russia, but the other two candidates as well, among the leading four candidates, Mélenchon and Fillon, were also very, very pro-Russian. So that illustrates, I think, that there are strong tendencies in Europe that actually quite like the approach that Trump is taking.
Aquí Francisco Mena nos pregunta, y esto también lo va a ligar con otra pregunta, va a tratar de que entren todas las de ustedes aquí. ¿Qué se puede esperar del el electorado común para los fines que busca la Unión Europea y no caer en el populismo? Porque la verdad, uno ve los procesos electorales y claro, las opciones son los extremos, que a veces se juntan por el lado de la izquierda, por el lado de la derecha, son hay que salirse de la Unión Europea, no hay que mandarle más plata a los burócratas de Bruselas, hay que recuperar el control de la frontera, y aquí preguntan también cómo hacer finalmente la Unión Europea para manejar la inmigración que viene de Siria y también agregaría el norte de África, porque las soluciones no parecen fácil y a veces los partidos populistas saben que siendo más estridente es como capturan más votos. Otra cosa es cuando llegan al poder y tienen que ver qué hacer si es que llegan al poder. ¿Qué puede hacer los partidos tradicionales? ¿Qué solución puede buscar el elector común o centrado, si quieres tú, que no quiere los extremos?
Well, I think the first thing they can do is vote. Because actually, if you look at whether it's the US presidential election or the Brexit vote, but also elections in continental Europe, the real danger is when centrist voters, particularly young people, simply don't go and vote. So, for example, if more Democrats had voted in the US presidential election, Trump wouldn't have been elected as president. If more Remain supporters had voted in the Brexit referendum, Britain wouldn't have voted to leave. And the big fear in the French election was this same issue, that lots of people who didn't really like Macron, hate Le Pen, but didn't really like Macron, would simply stay at home and not vote. And if François Fillon had been the candidate in the second round with Le Pen, this danger would have been even greater. So there was a real chance, actually, that Le Pen could win, not because young people were going to go out and vote for Le Pen that much, but because they basically saw this as a choice between two evils and would basically stay at home. So I think one of the lessons is voter turnout is very, very important. And by the way, this is what former President Barack Obama is now concentrating on in the United States, is basically democratic participation. Because I think the populists if voter turnout is very high, then actually the populists are much less likely to get into power. So that's, I think, what ordinary people can do, is just exercise their democratic choice and go and vote. And then what the mainstream political parties can do, should do, is more difficult. But I think it starts with being a bit self-critical. And looking back, this is what I was driving at with what I said at the beginning. I think we need to look back at what's happened over the last 30, 40 years and the policies that we've pursued in the West. And I think we need to think quite hard about the mistakes that we've made. Rather than simply, and I see this tendency too much in Europe and in the United States among the kind of political establishment, there is a tendency to say, we didn't make any mistakes, but people simply don't understand what's in their interests. And so we have to communicate better, but we shouldn't be changing the policies because the policies were right. People just don't get it. That, I think, is a very dangerous approach. I think we need to think very hard and very carefully about where we went wrong over the last 30, 40 years. So, for example, in terms of thinking about the losers from globalization and how we can do a better job of creating a kind of inclusive economic growth. So it isn't just a kind of zero-sum game where some people win and some people lose and we kind of forget about the losers. For me, one of the big lessons from last year, from Brexit and Trump, which I took very kind of, I mean, it hit me hard in both cases, my lesson is that we just need to do a better job of not just ignore a big part of the electorate, for example, the north of England, and just say, well, sorry, nothing we can do. I think we need to think much harder about how we can have policies that improve those people's lives and think more carefully about what we've failed to do over the last 30, 40 years. That would be my answer.
Junto con agradecerte de antemano el hecho de compartir tu visión y responder a nuestras inquietudes, me gustaría ya para ir cerrando y redondeando todo lo que ha sido tu exposición, que le diera a nuestros lectores tres tips o tres hechos en cuales ellos deberían fijarse de aquí en adelante sobre Europa. Como pedirle al mago que revele sus trucos, pero son tres hechos que debería llamar nuestra atención o encender nuestros semáforos de alerta en caso de... ¿En qué tenemos que fijarnos?
So three events that are going to happen, or
sí,
three...
o tres acontecimientos que tienen que llamar nuestra atención y mantenernos alerta.
Right. Okay. So, well, look. I'm biased because I'm British and I live in America, but I think that something very strange, but also very important, very interesting, is going on in these two countries. I don't fully understand it. I've been trying to understand it over the last 12 months, partly because these two countries, which I know very well, suddenly seem rather unfamiliar to me. So I think Britain, I think follow Britain and America, I mean, it's kind of obvious in the American case at least, but I think this is very, very, very interesting what's happening, and something very, very important is going on. Not least because these two countries are the two countries that you thought of as being most committed to economic liberalism, you know, going back particularly to Thatcher and Reagan, and there's a kind of revolt against economic liberalism. So that's very, very interesting, I think. Then secondly, watch the French-German relationship. We've talked about this already, but that's, I think, the future of Europe will largely depend on what happens between France and Germany. And in particular between Macron and Merkel. Forget the German election, because Merkel's going to win, it's sort of clear. That's not very interesting. And what's my third thing to watch out for? I don't know, I'm kind of stuck with the third one. I mean, I suppose the future of globalization is come back to where I started. I think that's the really interesting big question now facing the world. So all of these issues around trade agreements and what happens with trade policy, I think that's suddenly become a very, very important issue.
Perfecto. Bueno, junto con agradecer su presencia, invitarlo a un nuevo encuentro Mercurio, le damos un aplauso a nuestro invitado.
Thank you.